All right, so just before we get going today, people are still settling down here a little bit, but just I'll just say a few words. So upcoming here in Sydney, we're having, there's a few things on this month. So it's going to be a little bit all over the place, but just to reassure everybody, so the Friday nights will still be happening, okay? Venerable Brahmali is coming and so on. So if you're in Sydney, you know, go and see Brahmali's things or whatever, but we'll still be doing here for whoever wants to come or whoever's online. Likewise, even tonight, there's another visiting monk, Venerable Kasapa is teaching at the Lankarama temple. And if you haven't heard of him or what he's doing, I haven't met him yet. I'll be meeting him in a few days, but he's a very interesting monk. Basically, he's English, but he just kind of knew kind of spontaneously old Sinhala, and he speaks a very kind of ancient Sinhalese and became a monk and has lived as a monk for many years. So he's a really interesting character. I haven't met him personally. So he's giving a talk tonight at the Sri Lankan temple, and he'll be around in Sydney for a little while. So Venerable Brahmali is coming, so he'll be doing some talks and so on. Of course, we're doing our book launch on Friday, on the 9th at the Sydney Library. Please come. Those of you who are in Sydney, Mike, you're not far away. You can just pop over from New Zealand. Gita and Dorothy, it might be a little bit far for you guys to come, but, you know, make an effort. What can I say? So that's for the next, so basically the next month or so. Then as we come up to Christmas, we're doing a retreat, a 10-day retreat in Sydney over the Christmas New Year period. And so this is to give everybody an excuse to not have to be with their family over Christmas. So that's and even if you want to be with your family, but you want to get enlightened even more, then that can be even better. Or just bring your whole family along to the retreat. Why not, right? So that's Christmas New Year. Now, over that time, we will stop the Friday night for a few weeks. We haven't settled on dates yet, but basically over Christmas New Year, we'll probably have a few weeks off. So we'll let you know the dates for that as we come closer. But for now, we are continuing, as also we're continuing with the Wednesday night. A bit of news. I'll let you know more probably next week. But on Wednesday week, okay, so the Wednesday night is a only in-person event, but Wednesday, 1 week away, I'm going to be doing an interfaith event on climate change where we are responding to the Pope's latest encyclical on climate change. So that's coming up in Wednesday week, 10 days from now, and I'll share the link for that. That's a webinar, that's a web-only event. So if anybody's interested in that, then that will be coming up too. What else is happening? Anything else happening? I don't think anything else is happening. I think that's it. No? Okay, very good. All right, so as always, we should give respects to the Barramundigal people of the Darug Nation, who have been the custodians of this land for a long, long time, and they looked after it. And we pay respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. And when we do this, we shouldn't just do it in a perfunctory way, but we should also do it in the sense that, as a way of reminding ourselves that we have much to learn in terms of how we live and how we live on the land and in the place. You know, just as when we begin a Buddhist service, we begin by paying homage to the Buddha. We don't just do that in a perfunctory way, but we do it by reminding ourselves that we have something to learn from the Buddha, that we look up to him, we emulate him. In the same way, we need to actively make an effort to learn from indigenous people, because they're the people who understood this place far better than we ever have. So if we ever find an opportunity to learn something, then good. Okay, let us begin with the homage to the Triple Gem. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammā sambuddho vijja caraṇa sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manussana buddho bhagavati svathato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko ehi pasiko opanayiko pacatam meditabo vinyuhiti. Supapipanno bhagavato savaka sangho, ujjupapipanno bhagavato savaka sangho, nyāyapaṭipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho, samīcipaṭipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho, yadidaṃ cattari purisa yugāni artha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakirneyo anjali karaneyo anuttaram punya ketang lokasati. Okay, very good. All right, so time for some meditation, right? You'd like to do some meditation?
Let's do it.
Very good, do it. Excellent. That's what I want to hear. Let's smash some meditation. Exactly, yeah. How would you like to smash the meditation?
Crush mine.
You'd like to crush. You'd like to crush it with my phone. Sangha Nusati. Ah, okay. Okay. Okay, so we've been asked to crush mindfulness.
Crush mind with mind.
I think crush mind. Oh, crush mind with mind, right? I'm thinking you should start a YouTube channel on meditation. That would be great. Yeah, how to crush mindfulness in 20 minutes. All right. So sorry, everybody. We'll try to be relatively somewhat serious. All right. So for today, thank you for that suggestion. But for today, I wanted to focus on mindfulness of breathing meditation. As always, I'll just talk about it a little bit, and then we can do some meditation together. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to focus on mindfulness of breathing meditation is that I've been contemplating recently about the way that breathing brings people together, and the sense of vitality and the sense of life brings everybody together. In Buddhism, prana means breath. You're probably familiar with prana, like they use a lot in yogic circles or something. It means breath, it means life, it means vitality, right? But prana is also a word for a sentient being. Right? So any being, literally a breathing thing, is called a prana, although it's not meant as an exclusive term. Fishes are okay. They're also prana. They breathe, but just through their gills, I guess. So prana is something that brings people together. I was thinking about this. I went on Pindabhata today, and there's an announcement. We're in Little India here, for those who don't know. But so there's, you know, they have community announcements and so on. And then one of them was a religious festival or almsgiving or something like that. And they're basically saying, we don't care who you are. So, you know, it's really nice to say, we don't care who you are because we're all together in one God. And I'm like saying, well, you know, they're really making an effort to be inclusive, right? They're saying, we don't care about your caste, we don't care about your gender, we don't care about your color, we don't care about these things. Great, you know, they're really making that effort. And then there's a whole kind of God thing there as well. Yeah. But look, even from, you know, even if, you know, if you want to, if you look at it from a Christian point of view or something like that, then the breath is what God breathed into Adam in the book of Genesis, right? You've got a lump of clay. You know about that, right? The book of Genesis, and you breathe into it like doing, you know.
CPR.
Yeah, like doing CPR. I mean, that's what he's doing. He's bringing it back to life, I guess, yeah? And so that spirit can also be understood from that perspective as well. And, of course, the breath, like in ancient India, then all the different religions or spiritual movements took the breath as being, you know, something which is very primary and very important. So to me, breath meditation is really nice in that way because it connects us with something. We don't have to have an idea. We don't have to have a theory. We don't have to have a belief. It doesn't matter who we are or what background or anything like that, but we can all breathe. Yeah. So this is what mindfulness of breathing is about. So when we breathe, each time we breathe, that we're not only just connected with all other sentient beings in that way, but we're also connecting ourselves with the world around us. And it's through breath that we're sensitive to, you know, the atmosphere, to the air, and that we incorporate the world outside and we expel what's in us to the outside. So the Buddha's always saying, contemplating internally and externally, right? That means that contemplating that we, this little one in here, is also a part of something bigger. And the breath is the way that mediates this. And so this is one of the subtle ways that breath meditation works. Like these things that I'm saying, it's not just like an idea about the breath, right? It's about how you experience it. Because when you're experiencing the breath, you are literally experiencing the dissolution of the self. You see? Because what's in me goes outside and what's outside comes inside me. And so each time that we're breathing, we're actually like, what is it? Is the breath part of you or is it part of the air outside? Actually, it's kind of both and kind of neither. And so we are dissolving our ideas, right? Because when we do breath meditation, it's not based on a theory or a metaphysic or a philosophy. It's just based on something organic, something practical and psychological. So we're dissolving our attachment to theories. We're dissolving our experience of ourselves as an independent entity. We're also, breath is also on this nice little cusp of being neither intentional nor non-intentional, or rather both intentional and non-intentional, right? It's not like our heart, which we can't change, it's just autonomous, nor is it like the movement of our hands, which is under our control, but it's kind of half and half. It's kind of mostly automatic, but then we can control it if we wish. And so what that means is that it hooks right into that ahankara, that need inside our mind to control things and to build up our sense of self by controlling what's going on. And you realize that actually even our own body, our own breathing, the most basic, intimate biological process, is something that we can't control, or if we try to control it, we find ourselves getting tense and getting anxious. So there's something about the spirit of the breath, something about the meaning of it, something about the subtle qualities of the breath that almost like leech away that tendency in our mind to want to grab hold of and control things. Now, of course, despite this fact, and despite the fact that the breath has so many properties that want to lead us towards letting go, then it's very common that people will then have big fights and arguments about what's the right way to do meditation, right? And what's the right way, this way or that way, or do you meditate on the point of the nose, or do you follow the breath in, or do you want to contemplate the whole body, or just the breath, and then do you count, or do you not count, and then where do you look at the nimitta, and what do you do this? And so this is one of the kind of Theravadan family arguments, or Buddhist family arguments, right? So we kind of talk about all of these things and so on. And look, it's okay to talk about these things, listen to different points of view and all of those kinds of things, but just don't get too hung up on it. It's okay, right? It's just the breath. The breath is supposed to dissolve all of these things, okay? So just don't worry about it too much, okay? Just breathe and just be peaceful. And no matter what you think about it, no matter what your ideas about it, no matter what your theories about breathing meditation, the breath is there to dissolve all of those. The breath is there to take all of that complexity and bring peace. So rather than thinking of ourselves as something who has to control and do the right technique to get the right thing out of breath meditation, instead, why don't we think about, I don't have to do anything because the breath is there to calm me down. Let's do some meditation. So sitting quietly. Taking a few minutes to be settled inside your body. Evenly, steadily, just being there. If you have to adjust your body, then adjust it now, but don't worry about it too much, it's okay. Just find that tranquility in your posture. And as the energies and tensions in your body still, what becomes prominent is that gentle rhythm of the breath as it comes in and goes out. Breath coming in, breath going out. Breath coming in, breath going out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Can you feel that tranquility seep through your body? Can you feel the breath bringing you peace, calming you down? Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. So now coming near to the end of the meditation. I want you to bring your mind back into the senses. Hearing the sounds around. Feeling the touch of the skin. Take a minute to review the meditation, asking yourself what happened, what went on. Did you feel that tranquility of the breath? Can you feel it in your body right now? That liquid feeling of settling. And before we finish, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'd like to make a special dedication of merit for today for our dear Dhamma friend in Sydney, Amaradasa Leenagamage, who passed away about a week ago today, or tomorrow, I think. And some of you may know him. And he and his family, Rumi and Upal and Melanie, have been stalwarts of the Dhamma scene here for as long as I've been around. And Amaradasa was just a really lovely man. And one of the leading historians of early Sri Lanka, Anuradhapura and Polonnaruwa period. And just somebody who had that, I don't know how to describe it, but he had that sense of being who, that sense, I guess you call it character or dignity, that sense of being who he was. He wasn't out trying to impress people or anything like that. But everything that he said had a kindness and a wisdom to him. And it was always kind of very impressive and very nice to spend time with him. I happened to see him just about 10 days ago down at Santi. And he was fine, but then he had a stroke and rapidly passed. So anyway, merit of today for Amaradasa. Okay, please have a break and we'll come back for the Dhamma talk.
Okay, another one. I'm going to stop there. It's about Buddha's personality.
You know,
this very formal text.
Right.
So they kind of know him from that lens.
Right. Yes, but, something about the Buddha's personality.
His personality still comes through.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah.
Being super wise and compassionate.
Right, yeah. Okay, they're all really interesting topics, but they're also things that I might want to give a bit of thought to beforehand, because they actually are super interesting topics. But thank you, I'll bear them in mind, definitely. Anybody online have a suggestion? Okay. Okay, Christelle. Oh, Christelle's put a question in there in the chat. Look, Christelle, look, thank you for that, and I appreciate that, but I'm not going to speak on that one, honestly. And the only reason is because there's been so much online discourse about these particular questions that I'm thoroughly bored of it, and I'm really sorry, but it might be something that I look at sometime. But the basic idea is that there are mental processes which underlie how we speak. That's the main thing. Yeah. So that's the basic idea there. Yeah. Nilu suggests having limited time, okay. As Nilu has limited time at Santi, I guess. Okay. Anyone else with a Dhamma talk suggestion? Gee, you must have something. What's been on your mind?
Well, India lost the World Cup.
India lost the World Cup, did they? To who? To Australia?
Yeah.
Well, as an Australian Buddhist, I'm good either way. Okay, we'll just, okay? You're going to say? No, I was just, no, she's not going to say. I was just putting you on the spot, don't worry. Space-time, Dan.
People contemplating death and then they went crazy.
People contemplating death and then went crazy?
Yeah.
Asking for a friend here?
It's a new scene.
That's an interesting one. The Bhikkhu Nalayo does the, you know, the death meditation where you breathe in as if it's your last breath.
Right.
You know, that idea of understanding the breath and death and the process and realizing that every breath is the closer to the
right. Final, you know, yeah, I mean, that's the flip side of the breath, isn't it? Right. So when it stops. It's going to stop sometime. And yeah, that. Hope, and Nicola asks, hope versus hopelessness. Oh, that's a good one. That will hopefully come up in the climate change one. The Catholic climate change one. Right view, we started at Samasankapa for the rains talks, and we skipped right view. What? Science fiction novels and Dharma, theory of chaos. Sumana, that's an excellent topic. Science fiction novels and Dharma, the theory of chaos. okay.
Buddhist utopias.
Crikey. So many good topics tonight. It's really good. These are all really good. They're all topics that I'm thinking of. Can I give a talk on that? Okay, that's another one. I just want to come back to... Mike says that Majjhima 9, we started at Samasankapa for the rains talks and we skipped right view. Did we, is that true? I'm assuming that if Michael says so, it must be true. But, okay. Well, look, some great topics there, but they all seem a bit... a bit challenging, I'm going to admit. Sorry? It is nice. Look, normally I'm up for a good challenge, but I'm just not sure if I can wrap my head around those. Yeah. Limited time on Earth.
I have the same problem that you have.
Right?
Which is trying to make up your mind
on what to do.
All these options.
Yeah.
Which is the Dharma.
So yeah, I mean the thing with making decisions, like especially with important decisions, is that I mean decisions are very mysterious. Nobody actually knows where decisions come from. Right?
Bhante, can you hear me?
Dependently written. Sorry, Dan.
Bhante.
How do you decide? So you have to decide what are the criteria you are having before you can make a decision. Yeah. Well, look, you know, and look, we laugh, but that's true, isn't it? Yeah. And the reality is that you never know, but you have to make a decision anyway. And people say 2020 vision, hindsight is 2020 vision, but hindsight is absolutely not 2020 vision, because when you have hindsight, all you know is what happened when you made that decision. You don't know what would have happened if you'd made literally any other decision. So you hardly ever know anything more, even in hindsight, than you did beforehand. And yet we have to make decisions. So there was a tendency, I'm not sure if it's still a current thing in psychology, but there was a tendency at one point to equate decision-making with stress. And so, I mean, clearly they're closely related. Right, but it's even, you know, you can even think of them as being almost the same thing. So think about when you go to a supermarket, okay, and there's like how many brands of breakfast cereal. How many brands of toothpaste is an even better one. How many brands of toothpaste are there? So many different brands of toothpaste. It's amazing, right? You know what? They're all the same. They like literally come out of the same factory and put into different tubes. And all of this advertising and stuff is all... Yeah, I mean, there's like the gel ones and the sensitivity ones, which are a bit different. But basically, every toothpaste is exactly the same. And everything's just marketing. And yet we're putting there... Yeah, you get the cheapest one. It's like exactly the same as the more expensive one, yeah. Or, you know, you get the one that's, you know, the colour matches the decor of your bathroom or whatever you want. But they all clean your teeth just fine. So and then you create this kind of decision paralysis, right? So you're in this kind of state where you're blocked and you don't know. I was in a car one time. And my friend who I was staying in his kuti in Nan, and he was driving back from Chiang Mai, and there was like a fork in the road coming up, and he's coming up. He was a very indecisive chap, and he's coming up, and he's like, left, right, left, right, and then he just went right up the middle. And we just kind of sat there for a moment. And like... So at the end of the day, you've got to choose one, right? And so we have this thing, which one is the best? Like, and like, seriously, I mean, let's take the toothpaste example. I mean, how many different kinds of toothpaste do they have in a supermarket these days? I wouldn't know. I'd go to supermarkets, like 100?
It's like the same brand, but like 100 variations.
100 variations, which are just 100 different kinds of packaging. 20, right? And then different kinds of tubes and different sizes and different things and so on. But at the end of the day, it doesn't actually matter. So what are you going to do? Like, we think a decision means having to weigh up all the facts, right? But what are you going to do? You're going to go through the ingredients list on each one and then sort of research each ingredients list. But it's not just ingredients, it's also how they're put together, all of those things. Or are you going to just do it on taste? You could buy like one of each, right? And then go through, find the one that you like the best. But by the time you finish trying all those, they'll all be new brands anyway. So you won't be able to pay.
Yeah, remember the experiment that Bhante Nityananda was talking about?
Uh-huh.
Oh,
right, yeah, it's a decision, decision-making experiment.
That experiment's quite disturbing. It shows that we...
Mm-hmm. So you've been disturbed by that, have you? I'll come on to that in just a minute, yeah. I'll like to come to that in a bit in a second.
Decision's about timing, though.
Decision's about timing, right?
That's important. Time and yeah. Energy is connected to decisions.
Right. Yeah. So... So we're put into this situation of having to make decisions like all the time. Often, of course, the decisions are kind of on autopilot. Like, we don't necessarily think about it too much. Like, what are you going to have to breakfast? What are you going to wear? Or something like that. And you can, of course, get into decision paralysis. You can stand in front of your wardrobe and worry about what you're going to wear. I don't. But I mean, in principle, one could, right? In principle, one could. And of course, we have developed a society that equates having choice with being a good thing. Yeah. Now, and clearly, obviously, in some cases, that's true, right? And it's good to be able to make meaningful choices in your life. But at the same time, so many of the choices that we've got are either choices between things that don't really matter at all, or they're just actually choices between bad things. And to be able to choose between bad and less bad is not necessarily a great kind of choice. So we put in that situation, and then that creates stress. And then that stress then overloads your decision-making capacity. And so that's one of the... one of the things, again, there's been some psychological studies on this. I'm not sure how much credence to put into it because, frankly, I don't really believe any psychological studies, just putting that out there. And there's been such a collapse in, as far as I'm concerned, in the credibility of the field of psychological, especially in studies, due to the falsifiability and reproducibility crises that have afflicted psychology in the last few years, that I take any kind of results with a huge grain of salt. But anyway, where was I? So when we... I really have forgotten where I was. We were making decisions. Where were we just before that?
Stress loaded
decisions. Decision paralysis. That's where I'm at right now.
Toothpaste.
Yeah, I remember all those things. Ah, oh, dear. I completely forgot where I was at. Hopefully, I'll remember in a minute. Anyway. Okay, so. So we're in this situation where we are overloaded with decisions. Oh, that's right. Now I remember. There was apparently a study done on judicial decision making. Certainly an area where one would expect and hope that there was it was okay. But basically, they found that decision making changed in the morning and the afternoon. So judges would be basically you're more likely to get off in the morning and less likely in the afternoon because the judges are. Bit cranky, a bit tired, lost the decision-making process. Again, I don't kind of cite me on that. It was years ago I read that study, and I'm not sure whether it holds up. But I think the basic idea is pretty straightforward, that we do experience that kind of decision fatigue. And then that one of the remedies for that, of course, is meditation. Yay, meditation. And that's one of the reasons why we don't try to control anything when we meditate. Because what you're doing is you're resting your mind and you're allowing your mind to recuperate the energies and so on that it needs. Now, that brings us to a more subtle problem in the area of decision making. Okay, so when we make decisions, we deplete energy. Okay, fine. But we don't always deplete energy to the same amount. Yeah, so a lot of decisions we hardly even notice it. It's not a big deal. Most decisions not a big deal. But some decisions are really exhausting. All right, some decisions, especially if you have to make big life decisions. Am I going to get married, or get divorced, or have children, or buy a house, or all of these kinds of things? And these are things that can really send people into spirals. And it can be really exhausting because you can't make a list of pros and cons, and you can't figure out what are all the right things and what we should be doing or the things we shouldn't be doing. So the big decisions, and especially big ethical decisions, are really hard because they weigh heavily on your mind and they consume a lot of psychic energy. So one of the nice things about meditation is meditation allows a space for decisions to appear. Nice. And you don't even have to think about it. It's somehow just there. Now, of course, that's how decisions are always made. We just kind of don't really notice it. You're walking down the road, you've got to cross the road. Where do you cross the road? Well, you just kind of make a decision. How do you make a decision? Well, you just do. You're at the supermarket, you've got to buy a brand of toothpaste. How do you make a decision? It's just kind of there. Things have this way of just arising in the mind as if from nowhere. Now, of course, according to Buddhism, then this isn't random, right? There are patterns that we can observe, patterns we call these sankharas, right? And conditioning. And so we can look and we can understand to some extent the reasons for these things. But they kind of just appear. It's just kind of not there, and then it is. And decision-making and meditation is the number one decision-making tool that you could ever have, right? But there is a trick to it, okay? If you want to learn to make decisions in meditation, number one, do the work, okay? So think about what your decision, talk about it, get the evidence that you need, weigh up the facts. Right? Don't expect those things to make the decision for you. Yeah? But learn them nonetheless. Right? Get acquainted with all the things around it. And then you come to meditate and then completely forget all those things. That's the tricky bit. Right? You have to learn that skill of completely setting things aside. And this is why we develop the skill of meditation, so that when we don't have something big that's weighing over our mind, we can practice, we can get ready. And then when that time comes, then we can put that into practice. We've already learned that skill, setting things aside, letting the mind be peaceful. And so often you will find that the decision is just there. And when the decision comes like that, it comes when the mind is peaceful, it comes when you're not thinking, it comes when you're not worrying, it comes with a sense of confidence and certainty to it. Yeah? There's a clarity to it. There's almost like a familiarity to it, like a recognition that, oh yeah, this was the decision that I was had all along. Yeah? And, I know, that's what I'm going to be doing. So if you're really struggling with some kind of important decision, then don't forget either side of this. Number one, do the rational things, discuss it, do your fact-finding, you know, clarify the issues as best you can. But don't expect those things to make the decision for you. Then when you've done that, forget about it, and come and meditate. Yeah? But don't sit and meditate thinking, where's the decision? Where's the decision? Right? Buddha, give me the decision, right? No. Just wait. You have to be patient, right? It's not going to come the first time. And so it's almost like there's this, it's almost like the decision appears in your mind. It's almost like okay, I'm just kind of trying to describe it kind of energetically. Like we have what we call like the defilements or the hindrances or something like that, which are these different energies which are taking up space in your mind and your body. And these things, you know, you feel them as like tensions and movements and anger and desire and all of these things. And these things are taking up space. And then as those things sort of, all those things are there, and it's almost like you've got a decision that wants to come up, but it can't. It actually has to force itself through all that stuff. And that's why you feel that tension, because the energy of the decision coming up needs to force itself its way through all of these things. And the decision itself is then clouded by all those things, because it's part of it, it's just part of your mind. So you're like, well, I'm deciding this, but am I deciding this just because I'm angry? Yeah? And so you start to second guess yourself and to doubt your decision, and then that, of course, amplifies it all again more. So when you can let go of all of those hindrances, that your mind become clear, then the mind has that space and the decision can come up nicely and calmly. Ah, there it is, my old friend. Yeah? And because your mind is nice and clear, then you're not second-guessing yourself, doubting about what's this motivated by, or all of these kinds of things. That's how meditators make decisions. When we did the Bhikkhuni ordination in Perth, this is something Ajahn Brahm mentioned. That was how he made the decision. There was like when we did it, and then completely unexpected to us, there was this kind of eruption of hostility towards what we were doing, and all of these bizarre events started to transpire. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm was in England, so he'd gone to England to tell Ajahn Sumedho that he was doing this ordination. And then he'd gone on there, I think he was in Norway actually doing some teaching before coming back to Perth. And, you know, when he heard all about all of these things, and everyone in what Ajahn Chah tradition was telling him, stop it, don't do it, the world's going to end. I don't know what they expected to happen, but anyway, so we spoke to him and he said, no, I just went and did a meditation and I just asked myself, is this the right thing to do? And he said that's what Ajahn Chah taught him to do. And he said, when it came up, he said he knew in his heart that this was the right thing to do. So that's how he went ahead with that. And that, you know, that was a very stressful time for everyone. So this is decision. So come back to what you mentioned before, Pei, about the... So there's a study, a kind of much-cited study in kind of neuroscience. And I haven't really looked at the experiment myself, so I can't really comment on that with any real knowledge, right? But the basic idea behind the experiment, as I understand it, or maybe experiments, there's probably more than one, was that They can tell, I guess, through brain scans, MRI scans or something, that a decision's been made before a person is conscious of the decision being made. I think that's the idea, right? And so this was then used as an argument to say there's no free will. I think that's how some people argue it. Something like that. And because when we think we're making a decision, it's actually already pre-made, okay? So I'll just say a few things about this kind of study. First thing, see above, I don't really trust any of these studies, okay? And they all need to be taken with a huge pile, several cupfuls, ladles, like a bucket of salt, okay? Right? I mean, let's not forget, what is an MRI machine doing, right? Magnetic resonance imaging. An MRI machine is measuring magnetism, okay? You are not magnetism, okay? Why does it measure magnetism? Because magnetism is associated with iron. Why does it measure iron? Because iron is associated with blood. Why is it associated with blood? Because that's associated with your neurons working. I mean, it's a long chain of inferences and a very kind of fuzzy thing. I mean, they're basically saying there's a certain kind of activity in the brain at this time, at this point. I mean, okay, sure, but it's not like you're kind of peering into the mechanism of consciousness. And I think that people, and this also came out in that discussion the other day, because Venerable Metananda, he's a...
He said something about AI and use AI technology. So, like, if you're choosing between red and green, like, the AI could already predict
it. Oh, the AI predicted. So this is another one. This is another one. I'll come on to that one. I'll come on to that one in a minute. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that. So the MRI thing, and Venerable, we were talking with a monk who was formerly a neuroscientist about this and how it came up. And, you know, he was the same with everybody. I had a head of a neuroscience department came down to Santi one time and we had a long conversation about this. And, you know, I think there are a few things more annoying to a neuroscientist than the way that neuroscience gets overinterpreted in the popular imagination. And, you know, scientists themselves are very well aware of the methodological limitations of neuroscience, okay? Let me just give me, have I spoken recently about my golf simile, my golfing simile about neuroscience? No, I haven't, okay. Do you want to hear about golfing and neuroscience?
Yes.
Okay, very good, okay. No? Thanks so much, Alex. I appreciate that. I love that. That's so good. That's good. So it's really nice to know that people just have independent opinions now. But I'm going to go ahead anyway. So imagine that somebody wants to discover what golf is. They've heard about this thing, golf, and they want to find out, what is it? And so they build a big kind of MRI box, right? It's like a whole body MRI thing. And they get a golfer and they put them in the box and they say, okay, let's measure them swinging a golf club. Okay, and we'll find out what golf is. And they kind of measure it and so on, and they do all these things, and they're like, ah, yes. Well, we're getting these things like around the shoulders when they're swinging the golf club. So, you know, obviously golf is a kind of muscular activity of the shoulders and the upper arms. And they kind of do all this thing from MRI saying, well, we've now understood what golf is. You know, golf is about certain kinds of muscular activities and so on in the arms and so on. And so you get this thing and then you present it to a golfer and say, now we've found out what golf really is. And the golfer will say, what? It's got like nothing to do with golf. You're asking a completely different kind of question. And I think this is exactly what's happening when people are looking at brain scans and they're saying, this is what compassion is. This is what meditation states are. This is what all these things. They're just looking at these scans and just imagining that it has something to do with something that in all probability has literally nothing to do with. I mean, who's to say, just for example, who's to say that, let's say, when you're doing compassion, that, you know, certain parts of the brain light up and that's kind of associated with compassion and so on, right? But who's to say that the thing that matters about compassion is the things that don't happen? Just for example, yeah? Why is it that the doing of the something is the thing that it's of interest, that defines what it is? Maybe it's the fact that we don't do certain things that makes compassion, you see? So my point here is not that there's nothing to this or that we should be rejecting neuroscience. It's just that we just be careful about how we're interpreting it and just be cautious that, you know, remember that none of the neuroscience is based at all on any actual theory or model of consciousness. Right? There's no robust theory at all that guides this kind of research. So let's just be cautious about how we're going to interpret it. So the idea that you come back to that theory, that you make a decision, and then only afterwards you're aware of making that decision, therefore there's no free will. I mean, it just doesn't follow from a philosophical point of view. There can be a difference between a decision being made and a decision being presented. Think about how your computer works, right? Your computer's in there doing all these kind of processes, and at a certain time, maybe it's doing an update or something, and then it will tell you, oh, now the update's complete. You know, the computer's actually made the update, but when you become aware of it is after the thing. Yeah? That kind of thing happens all the time. So when we become conscious of it, doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the decision itself. In fact, we very often, probably the vast majority of times, never become conscious of our decisions. Right? We actually only become conscious in certain cases when they're quite important. So the relationship between when you become aware of it and when the decision is made is really a different kind of thing. It's got nothing to do with the question of free will. The question of free will itself is such a ridiculous philosophical non-question that I honestly, it's just so weird that we're still kind of wasting our time with this kind of issue. But the whole idea of free will only makes sense in a theological context. If you're God, you can have free will because you're literally just sitting there unconditioned. Right? God is unconditioned and able to do whatever he wants. Great. Yeah? And as they asked Martin Luther, what was God doing before he decided to create the world? And Martin Luther said he was sitting in a forest whittling sticks with which to hit people who ask impertinent questions.
Whoa.
So... Right? So in the context of God, free will makes sense. But in context of all of us, free will, what kind of nonsense? What does it mean? Like, why would it be good to have free will? It's just completely random and unaffected by things. I mean, it just doesn't make sense as a concept, like, at all. And so don't even worry about this question of free will, if free or anything determined. It's just a non-question as far as I'm concerned. It's nothing interesting about it.
Yeah. The answer for that question is... We do have free will, but that free will is determined.
Yeah, but the problem is that we're still making an assumption that the term free will means anything outside of a theological context, which I would argue it just doesn't. Yeah. So be wary. Like what I would say from a Buddhist point of view is be wary about being channeled into philosophical disputes that other people think are an issue. Okay, the debate between free will and determinism is very much a European philosophical dispute, which arises out of a particular theological, philosophical history. It's not an issue in Indian philosophy. Yeah, because they approach it from a completely different kind of perspective. So just this is why I just sort of be wary about assuming that because a lot of people have spilled a lot of ink about it, that therefore it's an important question. Sometimes these things just go away because it doesn't really matter. So then your question you asked about like another study of like an AI that's able to predict what you're doing before you do and these kinds of things. Again, you don't really need an AI for that, do you? right? I mean, if it's somebody that you know, then you can very often do that. Like parents do that for kids all the time. Right? You maybe like you go shopping, you know, what shoes are you going to get? And your parents, mum might know, oh yeah, they're going to get those shoes, but you can't tell them that these are the ones you're going to like. You have to let you go around and choose and so on, and then you're going to get these ones that you like, right? Yeah. Yes? Some parents are the back there, so that's the authority. And so the decision, again, this is this thing that the decision, you know, just think of the decision is made unconsciously and then it's presented to us later. So people again, what AI does or what parents do or whatever is simply inferring from a pattern, that's all. It's not knowing the future or anything like that. And, you know, obviously you can infer from what someone's done before and so on, but that's not what a decision is. Yeah. So just to come back to making the decision from a Buddhist point of view, the other thing that I would just want to kind of wrap up the discussion, but just the other thing that I would just be aware of from a Buddhist point of view. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, the making of decisions, having intention, having will, especially about important things that matter, like ethically, like moral decisions, right? Obviously that's really important for us. You know? That's karma and that's all of those things that's really important. But be wary of the tendency to just isolate that and treat it as something which is separate from everything else about who you are. Right? The kinds of decisions that we make are informed by the kind of person that we are. Another way of looking at the same thing is to say, well, we're the five aggregates, five khandhas, yeah? Form, feeling, perception, choices. That's where decisions come in, and sankhara khanda, and then vijnana is consciousness. Yeah. So if we think about it in those terms, the making good decisions isn't just about using our sankhara khanda. It's actually about the whole thing, which depends, for example, on living a good life, right? Keeping our precepts. It's about our sense of emotional connectedness and groundedness, yeah? So the more that we, for example, the more that you feel insecure, right, then the more you're likely to make decisions that are going to try to push your point of view or get across the kind of thing or something like that, rather than coming from a point of view of doing what's right. So we can't like hack decision making, yeah, to try to sort of somehow figure out a way to make that right decision outside of all of these contexts. And again, if we look at the five khandhas, when we talk about meditation, we're talking about the fifth khanda, vijnana. That's what we're developing in meditation, is purified consciousness. And that's why that's really useful for making decisions, because you're not just building up your behavior, your sila with the rupa, with your emotional qualities, with the vedana, your sense of community and belonging and all of those things with the sanya, and then your sense of individuality and decision-making with the sankhara, but you're also going beyond all of those things to have simple awareness, and the awareness that can be aware of all of those things, yeah? So you can, like, in the meditation, it's like we hop past the decision, and that gives us a perspective from which we see it, and that takes a lot of the desperation out of the decision, right? So this is the thing, when you have a hard decision, you're like, but this, what's going to happen if this happens, what happens if that happens? When you come into meditation, because you've transcended that decision, you put it in some context, you realize, oh, actually, it's okay. You know, I'll still be here. It'll be all right. We'll make a decision one way or the other. And that takes a lot of the sting and the tension out of the decision. So this is, again, is another, and just my final point I wanted to make is just that making decisions from a Buddhist point of view, don't think of it in terms of like a hack of how to make a decision, but think of it in terms of that overall practice, overall development, which has to be balanced and address all the different parts of who you are. Okay, so this is a talk on Buddhist decision making. Thanks for the good topic. Thanks for the topic. And very good. So, any questions before we finish? Yeah, Adrian.
So, you said that with the hindrances, when they're present in the mind, would you say that they're mainly influencing that fourth kanda, the sankhara
kanda? Are the hindrances mainly influencing the decisions? I don't know. I mean, they influence your feelings as well, don't they?
Oh, yes.
I think they affect everything. I mean, they even influence your body, you know?
Right.
And they certainly influence the behaviours of your body. Yeah.
Okay, what about decisions that are really hard? Like the story of the train driver turning right, hitting an old man, and turning left, hitting a...
Like the trolley problem?
Yeah, like those sort of decisions. Like, either way, that you need to make, like, instantly.
Right. Yeah. What did you do last time you were driving a trolley? You just
up in the middle.
Okay. Well, so the trolley problem is sort of set up. I mean, the thing with the trolley problem is, of course, it's deliberately designed to create a situation that's going to test your moral intuitions, right? And so I studied moral philosophy, right? And with Michael Tooley was one of my moral philosophy teachers, who was famed at the time for putting out a paper justifying infanticide in certain cases. So this is the kind of thing that ethical philosophers write about. And but again, the point is not to say infanticide is good. The point is to say, how can we interrogate our moral intuitions on these things so that even something which seems really extreme and impossible, then so it's a way of like testing things. So the same thing with the trolley problem. So one of the things that I noticed, like the difference between Buddhism and moral philosophy, is Buddhism focuses much more on building the center. Right? Building the center, reinforcing the essential moral qualities that make up your character, rather than trying to derive morality from the edges, from the cases that don't work and the paradoxes and so on. So in cases like the trolley problem and so on, you know, one of the philosophical assumptions, in a sense, is that there is a right thing to do. Well, is there? Yeah, so the Buddha said that there are black and white decisions that have black and white results. So you can say, I'm not going to do anything. Well, that's one decision. You can say, I'm going to switch over. That's another decision. And so sometimes there just aren't black and white results. So personally, I think things like the trolley problem have a kind of limited usefulness in terms of really understanding how morality works. I think the rational application of philosophy and so on, I think it has a role to play in making moral decision making, but I don't think it's the whole story. I think it's one part of it. Yeah.
When you were describing like the struggle of the decision making, for me it sounds very similar to when we have like conflict.
Uh-huh.
Like the dynamics of energy,
right.
the trying to find resolution.
Right. Yeah.
But when we have conflict, let's say I have a fight with someone.
Right.
A week ago.
Right.
And it's still going in my head.
Right.
There is no decision to make.
Right.
Is the solution the same? It's awareness to.
Yeah. Yeah, good question. So the question was about, just for those online, the question was about conflict, which often appears similar to decision-making in a sense. I mean, you can think in a sense of decision-making as being a conflict with yourself. You know, you basically have to, I don't think about duking it out. So yeah, it is actually, I think, a very kind of similar thing. But also you can have that with decisions, right? So you can make a decision and then regret it. Right, and again, keep double doubting yourself and second guessing yourself and so on, was it the right decision and so on. The more that you can have that clarity of mind when you're making decision, then the less you will start second guessing yourself. it's not unhealthy to second-guess yourself to some degree, right? It's good to be able to review it and say, was it really the right thing? Rather than just assuming that, you know, because it was me, therefore it was the right decision, right? That's obviously problematic. But at the same time, then we shouldn't get too caught up in second-guessing. It's okay to make wrong decisions because then you can learn from it. And same with conflict, right? You get into conflict, it's okay. But then you can reflect about it afterwards. Sometimes, as you say, there's nothing to be done. Sometimes there are things you can do. But at the very least, you can determine to learn from it and to try to do better next time. Yeah. Dan.
Hey, thank you, Bhante. That was really awesome talk. I was wondering like how decision-making might relate. I always like one of my favorite things is try to imagine the mind of an aria, the one, just try to imagine
it. Okay.
And I was always, one of the more interesting things, I was like issues like the idea of the self outside of a causal stream.
Okay.
Versus like somebody that's actually...
Is the causal stream, yeah.
So I wonder how decisions... speculatively talking, what do you think would be like the sort of decision that means that a stream enterer's decisions are within Sila? Like what is the point of view of the stream enterer making decisions? What did they see about free will that others didn't, that like, I can't get away with this lie?
So the question there again, I think this is that. So it's asking like, how does a stream enterer know that they're not going to make bad decisions? So for those who are not familiar, a stream enterer is someone who's in the first stage of enlightenment in Buddhism. So they're not like completely pure or completely free, but they are regarded as being incapable of making ethical violations, right? Especially like, you know, like serious ones. So, and so the question is, well, how does a stream enterer know this? It's kind of the wrong problem. What's happened is that the things that would cause a stream enterer to do those things no longer exist. Part of who they are is gone. Yeah. So it's not a question of, oh, how do I know this is right or wrong? There's simply the thing that would make you do it isn't there.
Do you think like with personality view and Sila Bhataparamasa and stuff, is it like the idea of like a person outside of reality? Like you were talking before about God.
Right.
God was outside.
Right. Dan's asking about whether in the kind of the views about the self that the Buddha talks about, whether those selves were thought to be somehow outside of causality. Is that right? Mm-hmm. That the people holding those views. It's a bit different because the philosophically, again, a difference between Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy. Western philosophy tended to, not completely obviously, but tended to have this idea that God was separate and apart from the universe and he created it and set it in motion. In some kind of sense, he sustains it, but he's not, you know, we're not God. And you can kind of get in trouble for saying that you are. Yeah. Whereas in the Indian tradition, that boundary was always a lot more blurred. So that in a sense, we are all God and there isn't a distinction between ourselves and our God. At least that's the Brahmanical non-dualist way of looking at it. But there are many different ways of looking at it. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to have to wrap up. We've been going on a little bit. So the Santi Sangha has reminded us that the talks are on Lokanta Live about a week after they are done. So thanks so much to Michael for getting those together and for all those who've helped out with that. And I will see you all next week. I think so, hopefully, unless anyone's dead. If you do die, then do let me know. No, I mean that. I mean, what are you laughing? No, seriously, no. Come and see me after you've died. Just let me know. No, it would be... Yeah. You see? It would be very... No, it would be. It would be great. So just thanks for that. Thank you. for those in Sydney, Wednesdays at the Crow's Nest Centre, I think this week Venerable Karunika will be there, so that's on Wednesday at the Crow's Nest Centre, and Friday next week we'll be back here. Venerable Kasapa is in town, so check out the various places to see where he's teaching, and Venerable Brahmali is arriving in town soon, so there's a number of events on here in Sydney. Yay! Okay. That's it, I think. Okay.